Hi, Christine. Thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Hi, Shane. So happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you today. You recently published a book about your journey, which was ostensibly a walking through hell and coming out the other side. And it's wonderfully written, and I think you're a terrific author. And I mean, you know, the story is about you and your suffering through, what was it, like 21 surgeries and 28 rounds of chemo or something like that, and all the battles that you went through and came out on the other side. And it's a really inspiring story, and it certainly instills hope, and it's a wonderful thing. So yeah, let's get into talking about it. I mean, how about we start off with just a little bit about you, and you know, how did you get to this point? I mean, maybe that's too general of a question, but for those listening, you know, what's a sort of brief of your story?
Well, the briefest version is I started modeling when I was very young, and I was very dependent on my external value. And I thought that that was all of that I was worth. And so I started to have these illnesses. Like, I don't mean like a cold. I mean major health issues, cancer, a colon resection, a fused arm. And when those illnesses started, I believed that I had no more value in this world because my beauty, my external, was being replaced by scars. And that wasn't acceptable in the world that I lived in. And so I did not build my life on self-esteem. I built my life on external value. And because of that, when I was losing my beauty, my inner warrior was falling apart. And so when I was going through chemotherapy, I needed to rebuild my life, but I knew I had done it wrong. And so it was a choice of how I was going to rebuild it. And I sought out, I looked around me and I saw my friends that were thriving, and I saw my contemporaries that weren't thriving, and I figured out what the difference was. And for me, I realized that I need to live a different way. And that way for me was serving. I needed to use my story to help other people to say, this is how it's not working. Mm-hmm. This is how I didn't thrive. And so I just sought out to live a different life. And fortunately for me, I'm much happier. I live very joyful, even though I'm in chronic pain. And it was just a life of rebuilding of my self-esteem and self-love and self-care versus being so dependent on what the outside world thought of me. Hmm. And their accolades, right? Yeah. That was fueling me.
Right. And this was after a great number of years of suffering through, right, that this sort of transition period of moving from, you know, what maybe we can say your sort of previous mode of being into this new way of being, right? It took a lot. It wasn't just like one day you had an epiphany and you were like, oh, okay, I'm good now. I know what's up.
No, it and I don't want to minimize the trauma part of it.
Oh, yeah.
Because the trauma part, it still stings, right? Even years later, it still stays with me. And it is a daily practice to work on self-soothing and self-coaching. But we're our own champions. If I don't cheer myself on, I can't expect other people to cheer me on. Mm-hmm. But in my previous life, prior to these illnesses, I was expecting my husband to take care of me. I was expecting my kids to love me. I was expecting the world to show me grace and to cheer me on. We shouldn't expect that. We have to expect ourselves to cheer each other, to cheer ourselves on. And I think that was what was tripping me up. I didn't have the self-confidence and the self-belief to do that.
Right. And so ultimately, you know, when these things were taken from you, I guess, is one way of phrasing it, it sort of forced you to reevaluate your position. I mean, you know, you sort of were sunken down to the absolute lowest that you could go. And then from there, you know, you started to rebuild a new way of life that sort of is much more fulfilling and, you know, all-encompassing and holistic. And I think it's amazing that you now spend your time, or some of your time at least, trying to share this wisdom with other people, right? And coming down and saying, you know, I've been through hell and this is what it looked like and I came out the other side. And now if you're going through that, or if you don't want to go through that, this is the sort of path that you can take, right?
Yeah. And I truly believe we are only as free as our minds will allow us. Mm-hmm. Right. And what I mean by that is I was paralyzed in shame. I was paralyzed in fear. I was paralyzed in self-doubt. And when we're not free, when we are paralyzed in those stages, seasons of our life, and it's our responsibility to dig ourselves out. Like, I seek podcasts right now. I seek people on social media who lead, right? Who inspire. I don't seek podcasts about e-entertainment news or, you know, what's popular in the world. I don't seek out social media influencers that, you know, post great TikTok videos of them twerking or dancing. I seek out people. I mean, but it's a choice, right?
Yeah.
And because whatever we feed our souls, whatever we feed our minds, either visually or just listening, that's what we're going to become, mm-hmm. right? We are what we listen to. We are what we follow, especially in the social media world. And so if we're not seeking that, if we're not seeking leadership, if we're not seeking inspiration, how are we going to know?
Right.
And so it was a choice when I was sitting there sick, going through chemotherapy, there's a lot of alone time. I had to fill that space, right? I could have filled it with watching Bravo TV. I could have filled it with E! Entertainment. I could have filled it with the Oscars or whatever, and or following the Kardashians or people like that. And I decided to do something different, mm-hmm. something that I had not done before.
And was that to find meaning for yourself, or was it really to just find strength in something else?
Well, it's a good question. I was trying to find a different way mm-hmm. because I knew that the way that I lived for 40 years was very lonely. It was very transactional. It was very empty. And I didn't know why. And it was when I was forced with, hey, this is your percentile chance of survival. Like at 41, you may die. Mm-hmm. And I had young kids and I was like, what was it all about? What was it all for? At the end of the day, you can't take any of this with you. There's no U-Haul behind the hearse. So like, what's the value in adoring beauty? What's the value in adoring Prada or the bag? There is no value in that.
Right.
The value is in what's inside. The value is in the wisdom. The value is in the self-love. Like, if I don't have that, I have nothing. Mm-hmm. But if I hadn't gotten hit against that wall, I'd probably still be living that very external driven life, that very materialistic life, trying to fill myself up with that stuff, but it didn't work.
Yeah, except for temporarily, right? You get those sort of temporary boosts.
Yeah. It's funny how so many people who are so wealthy are so unhappy, and it's because that money can't buy you happiness. Yeah. But if you go out and serve the world, I can't tell you how much joy that will bring you.
Yeah. No, it's true. And, you know, from the outside, it's easy to look at people and say, oh, they have the dream life, you know, they have the money and the family and the friends and the whatever it is, and say, oh, well, that must be it, right? And then you realize at some point, like, well, they could be suffering just as much, if not more, than you are on the inside, because that stuff doesn't provide any meaning or fulfillment. And it just gets you caught up in this sort of materialistic world, right? Not that materialism is completely to be disregarded. I mean, you know, wealth affords lots of opportunity and all sorts of things like that. But that sort of much deeper sense of meaning and purpose, you can't buy, right?
Right. Exactly.
And you also can't, you know, stave off cancer or, you know, like horrific medical treatment, even by the best doctors. It's not something you can just avoid. But what was really interesting for me about your story was that, I mean, there were a lot of things, but one of the things that came up was that, so for those who are listening, right, it really started with you when you had this colon resection, is that what it's called? That went really wrong. The surgery basically went really wrong. And due to a number of factors, including, you know, several sort of medical decisions, it led to them going from a laparoscopic surgery to a sort of full-blown abdominal, like, incision, because of bleeding. And then that led to all sorts of complications in your arm, which was, you know, tremendously mishandled for months, leaving you in severe pain and with nowhere to turn to. And I think you have a fused wrist now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and live in chronic pain. So, yeah.
In your wrist, is that where the pain is? Yeah. And then, you know, that lasted a couple years or something like that. And then to top that off, you know, you get a breast cancer diagnosis and have to go through what would seem like an eternity of treatment, right? And the reason I sort of bring that up is because, you know, it was just this colossal wave of bad things happening, right? And you mention in the book a few times, it's like, I'm a good person. Why is this happening to me, right?
Right.
And what I was really interested in sort of talking to you about, well, there's a few things, but firstly, faith, right? I think that it was a really important part of your story, both in the sense of how during those really dark times, you tend to lose faith, right? Because yes. You're like, well, God's obviously fucked me up and abandoned me, or how could he be real if this is what's happening, right? And right. Yet that sort of still played a central role, right? Like even in those times when your friends would talk to you or give you scriptures or things like that, it still sort of hung on, right? And then it pulled through like right at the end. Well, not at the end, but throughout.
Yeah.
And then it sort of, you know, once things get better, that's when you start to really open up and feel the faith a lot more. How has that sort of played out now? Like, you know, sort of years on from that.
Well, I mean, we all get hit by bullets, right? So to speak.
Yeah.
In each and every day, there's little bullets that go by and we can meditate on those bullets, right? But for me, when I used to meditate on those bullets, I felt great despair and duress and that trauma. I wasn't working through that trauma. And so when I changed my mindset and started to speak those scriptures, you know, do not worry is written 365 times in the Bible. Be still and know that I am God. Whether you believe in God or not, I promise you that is more comforting than believing in the world.
Yeah.
Because just look around and just turn on the news for 5 minutes. And so I don't throw my faith out there like it's convenient. It's not convenient. There's tons of times where I question it. Like, okay, well, if there is a God, why are children dying of cancer? I don't understand it. Why is there mass genocide? We can keep going on and on. I don't understand things like that. Obviously, we have free will and we can control to some extent how we react to trauma. It doesn't mean we're not going to go through it. And again, if we go back to the faith part, I may never understand why people have to suffer. But I do know that if I meditate on the scriptures that my friends taught me or the scriptures that I hang on to each and every day versus hanging on to the physical pain that I feel every day or hanging on to the news that we see that we're inundated with every day, my day is lighter if I hang on to that faith.
Yeah.
And so I continue to do that, but it doesn't mean I don't ask questions.
Sure. It's by no means I meant to imply a sort of blinding faith or anything like that, but...
No. I just don't want anybody... I don't want any of your listeners to think that this is an easy process. Oh, you can just have faith and life just, you know, gets better. It doesn't mean that.
Yeah.
And it's a daily... It's like self-esteem is a daily practice. You know, you go to the gym, you work out your muscles, you go to school to work on your brain... I am certain that every single person in the world needs to work on their self-esteem more and more each day. And it's just a daily practice. And that's the same way with faith to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't want to make it light of it. Like it's that easy. It's not that easy.
No, not at all. But it's amazing how much power there is in that, right? In that, I think faith is the best word because it's more than sort of belief, right? Belief is a lot more malleable, let's say, you know, from a psychological perspective. And faith, while, you know, you test it and you don't understand it necessarily all the time because, you know, the sort of workings of the universe are infinitely more complex than our mere minds can handle. It's just interesting how when you're in those moments, the world can't offer you what faith can, right? And it's not going to be the same for everyone, and that's okay. And, you know, whichever God or power or universe that you sort of look up to or feel connected to, that's okay. It's not a competition.
That's right.
But it is something that's more powerful than we sort of generally like to, you know, give credit to. And I think possibly because, you know, we live in a very scientific oriented world, and that's done tremendous things for us as a civilization. But at the same time, during those crazy dark moments, it's like, that's not going to help you, you know. Exactly. It's a little bit, I like the saying, it's like you're an atheist until the plane starts falling down, right? And then it's like, it doesn't matter how much physics or science you know, it's like, that's not who you're going to be asking for help to save you in those dark moments. But I mean, it's just a little, you know, silly analogy of the sort of mechanisms of it.
No, but that's so important that you brought that up, because if I followed the science with my cancer diagnosis, I would not feel hopeful.
Yeah.
But if I follow the faith, I mean, I had a doctor say to me, this is your percentile chance of survival. If I followed that science, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be, talking and inspiring other people. I'd be like paralyzed and scared and fearful and, you know, maybe not around. But if I meditated on the faith, that gives me hope, and that gives me hope to give to other people, right? And so it's a mindset. It's like so many people say, fake it till you make it. I think that's not true. I totally negate that.
Yeah.
I think asking for help takes so much courage, and faking how you feel doesn't help society. It doesn't help you, and it doesn't inspire other people.
No.
Especially like if we talk about social media again, you know, people are putting on this, their family reels, right? Of this fake persona. That's not helping anybody. That's inviting comparison. And so if I'm out here being very vulnerable and saying, you know, this stuff hurts, this is painful, this is a process, but this is what I chose to do, this is how I chose to inspire, these are my tools. Isn't that better than putting on a fake persona so that people just feel less alone in their, don't understand that. I don't know.
No, I completely agree. And we do live in a strange time of trying to figure out how to navigate, you know, the online world. And I think part of the thing about it is it comes to like what we were saying earlier, is that you do get that external validation that does feel good, but it's not satisfying in the deeper sense, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you can have like hundreds of thousands or millions of followers and you don't know these people, and yet there is some sort of a relationship that you develop with them. And yet if you're not being your true self, let's say, then is that really a true kind of relationship? I mean, it's complicated anyway, because you don't know them and they know all sorts of things about you, but you, at least if you're being honest and open, then they're, you know, connecting to the real you and not some fake, or not necessarily fake, but it's just, you know, a very specific version of you that you want to portray to the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, it is. It's very interesting. And it's a very tough thing for people to navigate, because vulnerability is not easy for anyone, right? And particularly public vulnerability is hard, because there are also lots of people who will have negative responses to that, mostly because of the own shit they're going through. But nevertheless, it comes at you, right? It does present a kind of a challenge to navigate, particularly if you're not, you know, pretty confident in yourself, where you can stand, you know, you can handle it and you can be like, okay, well, I mean, you're sort of lashing out at me, but that's really a you problem, right?
Right. That's so...
But that's the self-esteem thing again, is it's like, that's where you got to start. That's your rock to stand on, your foundation. The other thing that was really impressive, or made a big impression on me about you and your story, was the significance of your friends and family, right? Your loved ones, let's say, and how much they played an integral role, right, in your whole journey, and probably still to this day. I mean, it doesn't just stop when you get better, right?
Well, that's a whole other conversation, but yes. Sometimes it sucks for people.
Oh, like, do you mean the caring type who sort of likes someone
Well,
to care about, and then when that's over, it's like, oh, okay.
I think it's, I mean, I'm specifically talking about breast cancer because that's what I speak about. I hear a lot from breast cancer patients, survivors, who say once the chemo's over, people were like, okay, you were good, you're good, everything's fine. And it's really at that stage where you don't have as much support where things really go south. And so I think that, you know, people right now, well, I've seen on a lot of social media right now where people are saying, check in with your strongest friends because those people can be the most vulnerable, right? Like suicide and things like that, because Miss USA just committed suicide. And so people are now on this bandwagon of check your strongest friends. That's good to say, but we have to actually follow through with that. And so when people go through trauma and they look to the outside world like they're healed, that doesn't mean we don't check on each other. That doesn't mean we forget, right? Because that person, that emotional pain lingers. And so I think that's really critical to talk about because it's in that loneliness after the journey where people become despaired. And so my friends, they showed up for me, and they still do. My situation is different, but I hear so much from other people that they're not being carried by their friends after. But my friends really did carry me, and they showed up for me. And I think that the person that I was, the materialistic, the very transactional person that I was, I might have stayed that, even in all the pain, after the pain, if my friends hadn't shown me a different way. Because I truly believe that my friends were my friends because of what I could do for them. Now, this is before the trauma. And they showed me that they weren't my friends because of what I could do for them. They loved me for who I was inside. But remember, at the time, I didn't know who I was inside. I was always kind of asking myself, like, what do you really like to do? What really makes you tick? What keeps you up at night? And I just couldn't figure it out. I didn't have the introspection. I didn't do the time to learn about myself. And so when they started to show me love, that they loved me for who I was, not for what I could do, then I started to say to myself, well, gosh, if they love me for who I am, maybe I should figure out who I am. Maybe I would love me for who I am. And so that's what kind of jump started this self-esteem search that I went through. And again, I don't know that I would have done that if they hadn't shown me the way. And so I think by doing these podcasts and sharing this type of story, people might say to themselves, you know what? I have friends that are showing up for me. And it does feel transactional, or it does feel like they want something from me. Then I would reevaluate who you're hanging around, right? And I think that's also an important conversation because whoever you surround yourself with becomes also your focus. It becomes who you are as well.
Absolutely. And I think that that's a very interesting point because, you know, how before you viewed your friends and your relationship with them in one light, and that actually wasn't the case, right? I mean, maybe it was in some degree, but there was a lot more to it than that, let's say, right? Where, I mean, you know, much of your interaction might have still revolved around that kind of stuff. And, you know, those were your bonding points and things like that. But really, you know, when it came down to it, that wasn't what your real friends, that's not what they were there for, right? They were there for you. And, you know, and you would probably similarly be there for them in that kind of situation, right? But it's interesting how, like, you can see your relationships with people in one way, and then it actually isn't that way, or it is, but you don't actually know, right? Until something crazy happens, and then you get to find out who your real friends are, which is an unfortunate way of having to find out, let's say. But maybe that's a sort of silver lining of the whole thing. But I really like the point you made about how you sort of took the love that you were getting from your friends and took that in, like, into yourself, and sort of really looked in and said, okay, well, if all these people love me, could I love me as well, right? And you can apply that whether you have friends or family or, you know, it doesn't have to, you don't have to have a huge social circle. It can be one person where you can be like, okay, well, maybe there's something inside me that's, you know, worth looking at, which most of us don't do most of the time.
Which most of us don't do. That's the other important part of this. It's our perception isn't always correct, right? And sometimes we need to get, you know, hit by something like a trauma or a tragedy to go, what really is my perception? And take the time to really look at it and challenge people, right?
Yeah.
I mean, ask your friends, like, what are you in this for? And I think that by showing up for other people, you'll find who shows up for you. I call it kind of a courage net. I think it's really important to have people around you that you know are going to be there through all of it. Because there are times when even in my life and even in my story where I lost all my courage, I lost my bravery. I was like, I used it all up. I can't put one foot in front of the other anymore. And I got paralyzed in that. And my friends would shore me on and they'd say, no, we're picking you up. Let's go. Let's get out. And so we need people oftentimes to help us with our courage. But once you get back on your feet, then you can take that courage and you can say to the world, or you can say to people on social media, or you can say in podcasts or whatever, this is how I got my courage back. Mm-hmm. This is a resource for you. Lean on your friends. That's why I don't like the fake it till you make it. Because if you're in despair, you need other people to help you get out of that. All you know, this whole isolation these days is so damaging to our mental health.
Yeah.
And I don't think that we really understand the complexity of it, but we need people. We don't need things.
Yeah. And what's also interesting is the point about letting other people help you, right? Where I had, it was interesting, a few episodes ago I had on this guy's name was Dr. Craig Wright, and he was a numerologist, and he was doing a reading, and it was really fun. And one of the things that he said to me was, you have to let other people help you, right?
Yep.
And that was a really powerful message, because I'm the kind of person who doesn't like that. I'm like, I don't want other people helping me. I want to do it myself, right?
Yep.
I don't like other people worrying about me. I don't like any of that kind of stuff. And cognitively, I know that that's not a good approach to take, right? I understand why that's not the optimal way, but the sort of felt sense of it is much more powerful, and I suppose hardwired to some degree. But it really is important, because that's how we are as social creatures, right? We need to be there and help each other. And if you don't let people help you, everyone's going to suffer. It's not just
everybody's gonna suffer.
Yeah,
that's right. But don't you think it's pride and ego that keeps us from asking for help?
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, and once you get rid of that pride and you get rid of that ego of like, oh, I can do it better than anybody. I don't need anybody to help me. It's like once that washes away, it's freedom.
Yeah.
And it's not shameful. It's actually courage.
Yeah. And you know, lots of wise people have always said, like, it takes courage to ask for help. It's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength.
It takes a lot of courage.
Right.
It takes a lot of courage. Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
When I was faced with 28 rounds of chemotherapy and who knew how many surgeries I was about to endure, I was so afraid to ask for help because I thought to myself, I've used up all the chips from my friends and family with my arm. They've taken me to physical therapy. They've sat with me for 5, 6, 7 surgeries at the time. I can't ask them to show up for me more. They're using their resources. They're using their time. They're using, you know, they're not taking care of their own families because they're taking care of mine. And I was like, I'm not worthy of that. Well, that kind of shame, that kind of lack of self-esteem, that got me stuck for quite a while to the point where I almost took my own life. If I was like, well, if I can't get through 28 rounds of chemotherapy alone, which I'm going to have to do, right? That's my pride. Then I'm going to quit now. Mm-hmm. Now, ultimately, I had the courage to ask for help because I got rid of the pride and the ego. And I just said, okay, I surrender. I need help. But that took a long time. And that was kind of like this internal struggle where I was like, I can't ask for help. I have to ask for help. I can't ask for help. I have to ask for help. And it was like, oh, this is exhausting.
Yeah.
I can't live like this. I have to ask for help. And if people say no, it's okay, but this is more exhausting. I have to at least ask.
Yeah. And also the point is that people want to help, right?
People want to help.
And they, and I mean, in a different perspective, like they also get a great deal from helping you. I mean, that's right. It's a weird way to look at it, but ultimately you sort of, it's easier to see in yourself in terms of how, not you specifically, just one in general, about how when you help other people, you feel good. It's nice to help other people when they need you, right? And so you kind of don't let them do that when you refuse to let anyone help you. And then you suffer and they suffer because they want to help and you won't let them. And then you suffer because no one's helping you when you need it. And then it's just a mess, right? And it can end catastrophically.
It is ending catastrophically for too many people.
Unfortunately, it's the case. And I like and I have huge respect that you're going out and talking to people about these things because, you know, maybe someone just hears it and says, okay, well, maybe it's not so bad if I ask for help at this point. You know, no one does anything alone. I mean, you know, you could just imagine whatever great accomplishment or success, you know, you think someone has achieved for whatever value you attribute to that, I can almost guarantee they didn't do it by themselves, right? We don't live like that. That's not how it works. Even if it wasn't directly, it was like, yeah, but you were raised in a society and that gave you all sorts of things and options and abilities and capacities to do things. And so that wasn't by yourself. I mean, you might feel like it's a personal accomplishment, but that's the ego that, you know, you had mentioned. But yeah, and it's just sad that it has to get to a point where, you know, sometimes you just have to be like, I have no other options right now, right?
Desperate.
Yeah. True despair and depression and all sorts of fun things like that. and that's what really just goes, yeah, well, now's your chance, right? But I think that ultimately, you know, what your story is it's a story of survival, right?
That's right.
And the power of the human spirit, let's say, and the capacity to push through anything, basically. I mean, what could be worse, you know? And not to make up stories, but it's like that, you know, chronic pain and despair and depression and loneliness and helplessness, I mean, that's pretty much the worst that gets, you know? And to come out the other side and then take all of this great knowledge that you've achieved through your experience and want to share it with people. I mean, it's the ultimate hero's journey, right? That they sort of describe. It's like going through this massive battle and then you come back and you share the wealth with the community. And so I think that's great because some people would just be like, I'm the best. Look what I did. you know, and just have that inflate
that's
their ego.
That's ego. But it's never self-serving. It's definitely, I call it post-traumatic wisdom. But if I'm hoarding my story and I'm not sharing it, then somebody that's going through something that's even just an inkling of what I went through, then they're feeling less alone, right? Because they don't hear my story and they're like, well, I don't know anybody that's felt like this. Listen, a lot of people that read my book, they go, well, gosh, if she can get through that, and that, and I'm going through just this, this is easy, right?
Yeah.
And if for nothing else, you know, the multiply effect of, you know, so much trauma to give somebody or make somebody feel less lighter in their own pain, I'm all in.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't, and it's not, my story isn't flattering. Like, I'm not talking about like, you know, really flattering things about myself. I'm talking about being a materialistic, self-involved, you know, egotistical person who is dependent on beauty. Come on. I mean, I don't go around and saying, oh, my life was so perfect and look at all these bad things happened to me. I'm talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly and the truth.
Yeah.
And I don't do it for myself. I don't do it for my name. I don't do it for, you know, whatever the applause. I do it because I know there's hundreds, if not millions of people that feel the way I feel. They feel alone. I felt alone, shameful, stuck, paralyzed in fear, paralyzed in like, oh, I'm afraid to get older. I'm afraid to lose my beauty. I'm afraid to not have enough money. I, I remember that. That was me for 40 years. If I could tell somebody, if I could teach somebody so that they don't go through that pain or loneliness, I'd do it all day long.
Mm-hmm. So how do you sort of like approach that, right? If you're, let's say you're speaking to a group, right? And you sort of outline your basic story and you tell them
right.
what you went through and why you're teaching what you're teaching and where the wisdom has come from, right? I like the term post-traumatic wisdom. I think it's brilliant.
Cool.
Yeah. So when you sort of present that to people, what's your approach in terms of saying, okay, well, here's a better way of doing it? Like, do you have a method that you teach, or is it more just telling people to like take the time to introspect and to learn to love yourself and self-soothe and self-care and do all of the good things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you apply real life experiences to those things, like the self-esteem, why do I have a fused arm? I allowed a man, a doctor who went to Stanford University, right? Who had the plaque on the wall. I believed him over me.
Mm-hmm.
Why did I do that? Because I was taught that I was supposed to adhere to authority at all costs. That was wrong. But I didn't have the self-esteem to question him, right? So if somebody hears that story and goes, huh, I'm in pain in my arm, I'm in pain in my leg, I don't want to get a second opinion because my doctor told me I don't need to. That doctor is prideful, and that doctor should want you to see a second opinion. But I didn't have the self-love that I needed to, right? So if I apply those stories and people hear those stories, then they're more apt to apply them to their own lives. I can say to people all day long, you have to work on your self-esteem. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
That means listening to your voices inside your head. Are you calling yourself names? Are you putting yourself down? Or are you cheering yourself on? But you have to spend time to actually listen to your voices. And I use this as an example. I play tennis. It hurts my arm very much, but I love it. And it gives me more psychic dividends than, you know, physical, obviously. And a few weeks ago, I was playing tennis and I hit a really bad shot. And I said to myself, you suck. And I'm so used to questioning my thoughts that I stopped myself and said, no, you can't talk to yourself that way. And I changed the thought. But if you don't spend time changing the thoughts or listening to the thoughts, you won't ever change them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's great self-love work. That's great self-esteem kind of boosters. But, you know, it's helpful to people when you apply stories. And so it's like I use that example about going to school and you working on your brain. You have to also go to school or your own school, find podcasts about self-esteem. There's tons, Super Soul Sundays. There's tons on Oprah. There's tons out there. Just Google podcasts on self-esteem and you'll just be fed all this information. I would suggest doing that every day over watching the news, because the news is fear-based, mm-hmm. right? And I'm not saying we shouldn't hear what's going on in the world. We have to take that in bits and parcels. But what we have to fuel our soul with is the things that will cheer us on, right? And that's fulfilling, like, important podcasts. That's reaching and seeking out for things that are positive and healing and inspiring. And so just doing those things help you each and every day, and they build up that self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not easy. It's a process. And I don't want to act like, oh, I'm this really strong person, I'm unstoppable, which I am. But it's taken me years and years and years of doing the work, doing the introspection. So for me, when I'm talking about my story or I'm leading people or trying to inspire, it's taking those really, really, you know, uncomfortable moments of my life and saying, I did this wrong. But not only did I do it wrong, this is a better way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Which is not easy, because you really have to be willing to evaluate yourself objectively and to be careful not to fall into the trap of self-reproach in that process, right? You got to deal with it in a compassionate way, like you would, you know, a friend or a loved one, because it's no good telling yourself, oh, I always do this, I always suck, and I can't ever think right, and then being aware of that and just having it go down a different spiral along the same lengths, right? You have to kind of approach yourself carefully.
Well, and somebody taught me a long time ago that we should not use the words always and never.
Yeah.
Because they're not true.
Yeah, dichotomous thinking. Right? It's a problem.
Right?
Yeah.
And I used to do that. I used to say, I'm always whatever. I'm never whatever. That's not true. Always and never, they're not words that should be in your vocabulary.
Yeah. You should never use always and never.
Exactly.
But it's true. And it's important that it is understood as a process and that it's not easy because you've had a lifetime of thinking in a particular way. And it goes, you know, I mean, depends how deep you want to go, but it tracks real back to early childhood and how, you know, your parents related to you and how your friends and teachers and all that kind of stuff taught you how to be in the world. Yeah. And, you know, those are the voices that you hear in your head correcting or criticizing or praising certain behaviors. And then you actually can change that. But, you know, to compete with 30 or 40 or 50 years worth of thoughts, it takes a while, right? And it's not easy, but it's worth doing because what else is there? You know, you're just going to beat yourself into the ground otherwise.
Yeah, so if we take that logic, which is true, by the way, your formative years do form you.
Yeah.
But you have to go back to those formative years to see how it formed you. And then go through the steps to change that without blame.
Mm-hmm.
That's the important part. Because we can all say, well, my parents screwed me up. Oh, my whatever. We can blame all day long. That does nothing for us. And it's cutting our self-esteem.
Right.
Like it's justifying the anger or the unforgiveness in our hearts. We can't do that. That's not helping us. And so it's like, okay, this happened. This exists. The formative years did happen, but I'm going to take that and I'm going to unpack it and I'm going to choose a different way. Was I hurt? Of course, everybody is, but I'm not going to live in that unforgiveness.
Yeah. And that's a good point actually, because it doesn't help to just attribute blame to other people or the world. Cause I mean, how does that help? It just, you're right. It fuels the anger and the resentment and you feel justified then in your anger, right? But that's not really helpful. Maybe it's an understandable sort of, you know, experience that you might have, but then, you know, you look at that and you say, okay, well, this isn't really the best way to approach it. Because, you know, again, we don't want to get stuck in more self-reproach. So if you have a thought of blame or resentment or a feeling about that, you can't be like, oh, I'm doing it badly now, you know?
Right. That's right. Well, that's self-criticism.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you got to be good to yourself and treat yourself carefully. I mean, therapy is usually where people go to, you know, go deep on these problems, but there's other ways to go about it, right? Podcasts and things like that. And there's so much out there. And there's so many people that have lived it and are preaching their wisdom, right? That it's
thankfully,
and it's not like it's just some people who are just saying some shit, but it's a really widespread movement, and it's powerful, you know.
Yeah.
So, in terms of like where you're at now, right, with your healing journey, what's your sort of sense of where you're at, and sort of how it's going for you?
So I would say for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been kind of had my head down and focused completely on helping other people and working in any way I could to inspire. So that meant social media, that meant, you know, on interviews, that meant writing, that meant with my book, with the movie. And I'm on the board of 2 nonprofits. So my whole life was kind of encompassed in that. But what I kind of dismissed was the personal part of my life. And so for me right now, I'm trying to do a little bit more balancing my work and school. I'm also in school. So balancing my work, school life, and my personal life, which I'm not great at doing.
Yeah.
So I would say I'm trying to rebalance and focus on having some, you know, personal time moving forward. I've absolutely accomplished everything I wanted to. And that's not a prideful thing. I've done what I set out to do. And I'm going to continue to do that. but not with a level of intensity because it's not sustaining.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I take a few steps back, add a little bit of personal life to my life and do what I do with taking a little bit of step back, then I think that will be more balance in my life. So that's kind of what I'm, that's my goal of this right. next season of my life.
That's good. And I, you know what, it's important that it's kind of, what's interesting is that, you know, you can reach different phases in your life. And even though you've had, you know, all these experiences and you've come out with this wisdom, it's like, well, yeah, but you can still get stuck doing things that are not the most helpful, the most balanced. You know, there's no ever final perfect solution, right? It's always a matter of figuring out what works, what doesn't, and just making those sort of careful, careful corrections.
That's exactly.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, your story was really crazy. I mean, just to sort of give people an understanding of what happened, right? A teaser of the book, let's say. just like the story with your arm and these doctors, right? Let's just, if you don't mind, let's just go through it for like 10 minutes. It's one of the most upsetting stories that I've read because it's hard to believe that, you know, such doctors are out there. And yet, at the same time, it's like, but you also eventually found ones that were amazing, right? And yeah, and did what you expect in doctors. But so yeah, so basically, what happened?
Yeah.
Let's say I'll start off, and you can carry on. Yeah. Oh no, you start off. What am I talking about? It's your story.
Let me start with this. When I was diagnosed with cancer.
Mm.
I was in a cast from my fingertips to my shoulder on my right arm. That's my dominant arm. And I had, my arm had just been grafted and fused, fully fused, which means game over, no function at all in my wrist. And I had to go find an oncologist for breast cancer, and I didn't trust any doctor. And I'm going to go back to why. And I walked into his office and he said to me, "Oh, you're the girl with the arm." And that immediately diffused my anger, fear, because he did his research. Mm. He knew who I was. He knew what I was coming in with. He knew I was starting off really depleted in the cancer world. And so I was like, this guy cares. This guy has compassion. And I had lost all belief in the medical field. And I'll tell you, I'll go back to why. So when I was 40, I had a torn ligament in my right wrist. No big deal. I went to see three different surgeons and I found the Stanford grad, you know, the best, I don't know, whatever you call it, pedigree, at least I thought. And he came well recommended. Like he was in the best area, whatever, you know, the best. And I believed he was the right man for this. He was young and he told me what I wanted to hear. And so he repaired the ligament and I was in a cast for 6 weeks. And the cast came off after 6 weeks and they sent me home with some physical therapy exercises that I did over the weekend. And by Sunday morning, my arm looked like my thigh bone. I woke up and I was in so much pain. The pain was dramatic that I called the doctor on a Sunday, which by the way, I was afraid to do because I was like, oh gosh, I shouldn't interrupt the man on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bad self-esteem right there. That's the first clue of a bad self-esteem. Shame, by the way, is the first clue of a bad self-esteem. And so I called him, he called me back and he told me I over-iced my arm. Well, I didn't go to medical school. And so I said, okay, I've had ice on my arm for 5 hours because the pain is so traumatic. I'll take the ice off. Fast forward a couple days, I'm still in bed holding my arm on my chest like a child. Like I have my arm, I won't even drink anything. I won't even eat anything because I don't want to get up to move my arm. I don't want to use the restroom. And so my arm's on my chest and I'm just laying there and I'm shaking because when you're in that kind of pain, your body shakes. And so I'm trying not to move my arm. And of course, I'm getting mad at my body because it's shaking. So two days later, I finally get in to see my doctor and he doesn't see me. He sends me to the physical therapist in his office and she says to me, "You've done too many exercises on your arm. I'm going to splint it." And so again, there's that shame. I did something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's my fault. So I went home, and a week later, the pain did not get better. Now, I was starting to lose my hair, or like thinning hair. I couldn't take care of my kids because I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't drive a car. I couldn't cook. The pain was enormous. So I finally went in to see him again, and he did no x-ray. He did no blood test. He just said to me, gosh, this is such a shame, but you have this thing called RSD, which is basically your brain is telling your limb, which is my right arm, that there's pain and swelling, but there's really not. It's just a misfire with your brain and your limb. And I was like, oh, why is that happening to me? Gosh, of course it's happening to me, right? There goes the self-esteem again. So he goes, I'm going to send you to this pain management doctor. She'll get you some medication, and then we'll figure out what to do. Okay. I'm a rule follower. So I go down to the pain management doctor. She concurs with his diagnosis. So now I have two medical degree doctors who said, this is what you have. That's a second opinion, right?
Yeah.
And so I believe them. And then I start on this medication, which is making me feel a little bit better. The pain is a little bit less, but now I can't drive because I'm drugged up, and my I'm cloudy, and my stomach's hurting because of all this medication. And I go into my doctor and I say, well, isn't there something we can do? Because this is not sustainable. So he says to me, well, we're going to do a nerve block in your neck where we're going to stop the fire from your brain to your arm that there's pain. Okay. Now that's anesthesia. That's a surgery. No, I mean, it's a surgery. It's a procedure. Mm-hmm. But it's dangerous. If they miss the spot on your neck, you could become paralyzed. Mm-hmm. But here I am putting all my trust in this doctor who's telling me this is what it is and this is what we have to do. And when you're in horrible pain like I was, you don't remember anything but how to get out of pain. So whatever he was telling me was all I was focused on. Just get me out of pain. Mm-hmm. And so I do the nerve block. Nothing happened. The swelling didn't go down. The pain didn't lessen. Nothing happened. So they do a nerve block the next week. Same thing. Anesthesia. It's a procedure. You check into a hospital. So now I've had now two extra procedures, more anesthesia, and nothing happened. The swelling didn't go down. The pain didn't go down. And so he said to me, I'm going to send you to a physical therapist like far away from his office. Now, looking back, right, you can see all these clues that were happening that I didn't see then. And he is an expert in the RSD world. And so he's going to try to get your limb, which is my wrist, to work. Because what happens with RSD is you have about a 6-month window. And whatever part of your body is being affected by RSD, that limb will ultimately not have any more flexibility. So you're going to work really hard for 6 months to try to get some movement in your wrist before it locks down. So now I'm in a fight. So now I'm racing to try to get my wrist to work. And I don't know how long we want to talk about this, but for months, the doctor was bullying me. For months, he was saying to me, not just the pain and the swelling was in my head, but when a piece of metal came out of the opening from the original surgery, because the opening of the laparoscopic surgery kept opening and bleeding. When a piece of metal popped out of there, I took a picture of it. I was taking a bath because I was in pain and suffering and just trying to calm down. And this piece of metal with a bunch of blood pops out of my arm. And I take a picture and I send it to him. And he says to me, how do I know you didn't take that picture on the arm of an airplane? And I was like, I felt so much shame. I didn't even tell my husband for 2 weeks because I felt like, am I losing my mind?
Yeah.
Is this actually happening or am I making this up? Did I take this off the, I mean, and I'm a logical, I'm an intellectual, and he's like making me think I'm crazy. It's called gaslighting.
Yeah.
I mean, but at the time I didn't know, right?
Yeah.
And again, when you're in that kind of pain, all you care about is getting out of the pain. And so I kept going to physical therapy, and I finally had a friend say to me, you should see a second opinion. And, you know, she wasn't the first person to say it, but she had a doctor who she knew from high school. So she said, I will have this guy over to my house. You don't have to go far. Just come over to my house. So ultimately I did. And he had me come into his office a few days after I met him. And he took one x-ray of my right wrist and every single bone was broken. And there was no cartilage left in my wrist. I was in emergency surgery that day to save my arm. And so what had happened was, for months and months that I was going to physical therapy, when they were pulling my arm and hooking it up to electricity and all these things to get my wrist to move, every day my wrist was breaking. Because I had an infection in my wrist from the, and they dated it back to the day of surgery, which, by the way, 20% of all surgeries ends in infection. It's not the doctor's fault. But if you don't look for it, if you don't treat it, then the infection gets out of control, which obviously it did. So it was an emergency surgery, but by the time that I found the infection, it was too late to repair my wrist. It was completely destroyed, which is why it was fused. But it was a malicious doctor, an egomaniac, and it was a lack of self-esteem that created this like fire, right? Mm-hmm. And I couldn't stop it because I was like so focused on, this guy went to Stanford. He's the best doctor. You know, you have to listen to authority. And it was just this massive, colossal disaster, which, by the way, I still pay for because I'm in constant pain.
Yeah.
But when you go through something like that, your life changes, not necessarily for the good. Mm-hmm. There's so many people that get bullied in this world that, one, take their life, or two, never get over it. They never, ever get over it because their self-esteem is so destroyed by people like that, that they never bounce back. It takes so much courage and bravery to call somebody out who does that and then to get your self-esteem back. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Anyway.
I mean,
trauma.
It's real trauma. It's crazy because it just breaks your trust. Right?
I'm sweating.
Yeah.
Just talking about it. I'm sweating.
I'm sweating too. And when I read it the first time, I was like, it just makes you so angry, right? Just about how that's, I mean, how just some people are, right? And yeah, listen, I believe in karma, so we'll see what happens to that guy. But I don't personally wish him harm.
It's such a waste.
Yeah.
It's such a waste. But because I speak about it,
yeah.
I can't tell you how many messages I've gotten from people who read my book or who, when I talk about this, they've messaged me and said, I went to see a second opinion. And because I listened to you, that saved this limb or that saved this problem, whatever it was. Because I'm sharing this, it's giving people courage to say, okay, no, I'm not going to listen to that. I'm going to see a second opinion. So for that,
yeah,
that's great.
And also, I guess just the last point on it would be that not all doctors are like that, obviously. It's unfortunate when you find one that is, but there's also an immense amount of amazing doctors who will do anything they can to help you and who are really in it for the right reasons and, you know, that end up saving people and doing tremendous things. So it's not that one should give up on medicine or distrust everything, but it's just like, just listen to what your body's telling you. If your body's telling you something's wrong and other people are telling you it's not, figure something else out, right?
Believe in yourself. Yeah. That's where it goes back to self-esteem, yes. Trust yourself.
Yeah, trust yourself. Well, listen, Christine, this has been a wonderful conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find you? Where can they buy your book? Please, you know.
Thank you. My book is called Walk Beside Me, and you can buy it really on most online platforms. I try to steer people to Amazon because it's easy. And I'm on social media, Christine Handy 1 on Instagram. But in general, if you Google Christine Handy, my website comes out up. And I hope that you reach out to me because I do love talking and communicating about all of this stuff. It's so important. And I do respond to my messages. So please reach out. I'd love to talk to you.
Good. Reach out and read the book. It's worth a read. Well, thank you again. And look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Thank you.
Take care.